So many of you know that migrants, mostly from Guatemala and Honduras, continue to take the long journey from Central America to our border. And there are busloads of these asylum seekers that have been arriving in Albuquerque. And they stay here until they're bused or flown to other states where families who have signed up as sponsors will be waiting for them. In the meanwhile, they need to be housed and clothed and fed while here. And there are many organizations, churches, synagogues, and individuals who've been coming together to welcome and care for the families that arrive. And joining me today are four women among many more who have committed themselves to ensuring their basic needs are met while they are here in Albuquerque. And I wanted to focus this afternoon on the efforts of people in our community who have chosen to welcome and support the families in the time that they're here. So let me introduce you to my four guests. I thank you all for being here this afternoon. Celia Yapita is with Catholic Charities. You're the program director, is that right?
I'm the chief program officer,
yes. Yeah, chief program officer. She's a chief program officer. And when I told several people that I was planning to do this show, this topic, those in the know told me, I must contact Celia. I must. Well, and so I did, and I was so happy that you were available and interested in doing this. I'm so pleased that you're here today. And also with us is Jessica Corley. She's a board member and vice president of the board of Congregation Albert. She rallied together teams of volunteers to assist some of the busloads of asylum seekers arriving here. And she was inspired by her daughter to get involved. And she, her daughter, is here today, and that's Emily Alvarez. She joins us today. She's a co-site leader along with her mom. We'll find out what all that is about. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And I do want to say, because I don't want to forget, that Congregation Nahalat Shalom in Albuquerque, I want to acknowledge the volunteers from their congregation who are working together with the Congregation Albert volunteers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I also welcome Elena Yoder. Am I saying that last name right?
That's right.
She has spent a lot of time in Guatemala and Honduras and is a member of the Mennonite Church here in Albuquerque. And she has an important role in assisting the asylum seekers, and we're going to talk about that shortly. So thank you all for, again, for being here. It's much, much appreciated. Well, you're all taking on quite a bit, and I want to start with Celia Yapita. Can you just briefly, you're with Catholic Charities. I don't think I've ever had in all these years anyone on from Catholic Charities. So briefly, tell us the role of Catholic Charities in our community.
Well, Catholic Charities has been active here in Albuquerque for about 70-plus years. We are the social justice arm of the Catholic Church. Our funding and our mission mean that you don't have to be Catholic to work or volunteer or receive our services. We have about six different large programs that serve the community. We have a children's learning center. We have adult basic education, which is English and high school equivalency and citizenship classes offered throughout the community. We have a four-fee immigration department, which charges much reduced fees to help folks getting their green card or citizenship. We have a refugee department that has served for many years our folks coming from Africa and Afghanistan and the Middle East who are refugees as they enter. And we also have a housing department, which has HUD housing to serve folks who are homeless. And then we have a community involvement department, which has a senior transportation program, as well as parish liaisons and all the wonderful connections we make with our faith communities and outreach in the community.
Yeah, it's quite an organization. Cecilia, why did you choose to do this work?
Well, the work that we're talking about here today, or just in general, the work of Catholic Charities?
Oh, the work of Catholic Charities. And a lot of that kind of reflects on
sure.
what we're going to talk about today.
So I started Catholic Charities 10 years ago as a volunteer. And I had young children, and I needed to find a place to help. I needed to get away from my children a little bit and find a place to help. And Catholic Charities has a really robust volunteer program. The work we do, we could not do without our volunteers. They are crucial to every aspect of our program. We depend on funding and grants, and those are very limited, honestly, sometimes in what we're able to do. So I started as a volunteer, and I started specifically with the refugee department. And eventually I taught classes. I did culture orientation. I did tutoring with English with folks, and eventually became the center director, and then became the chief program officer over all of our programs. And then, of course, the work we're doing right now in community with all the folks I'm sitting with here and so many people was a natural extension of the work we had already been doing with refugees and asylees.
Do you consider it sacred work?
Absolutely. You know, we all come to this work for different reasons, but it is what, you know, gives my life meaning to be able to help. And again, to be able to work with alongside other folks to do this important work.
Emily Alvarez, I think you work some with Celia.
Yeah, so I actually got started. Our congregation got involved because I volunteered with two different busloads receiving people through Catholic Charities, and the need for more organizations to take part in this became so strong that instead of volunteering as a volunteer with Catholic Charities, we've taken on our own organization, mm-hmm. our own buses.
Well, what drew you to this work?
So my husband is from Mexico. It took us 2 years to get him his visa, and luckily he just got it. But I have been very involved and aware of immigration for a long time. We lived in Mexico, and I wanted to use my Spanish for something meaningful rather than just because I spoke Spanish. And they needed Spanish people to volunteer, and that's kind of how I got started.
Okay. And your mom,
yes.
Jessica Corley, what you had told me when I first contacted you, that it was really funny because I was getting I think I told some of you, I went to bed one night, and as my head hit the pillow, for some reason I said, I have got to do something about these buses on the radio. I just felt compelled to do it. So the next morning I started contacting people and trying to get contacts for people to call to be on the show. And the name Emily Alvarez came up. And then another friend told me about Jessica. And when I got on the phone with Jessica, we were ready to get off the phone. We were talking a long time. And I said, you know, do you know anyone by the name of Emily who's doing this work? And because I remember, Celia, you mentioned Emily, and then I realized Emily and her mom, and you said to me, Emily's my daughter,
right?
So we all have met up, and that's really great. But you did tell me that she inspired her. It's because of your daughter
right.
that you got involved, and you're doing a whole lot right now. Why don't you just tell us what it was that drew you to work with these busloads of folks that are coming from, have made the long journey from Central America.
Right. So as Emily said, her husband, our son-in-law, with whom we've been trying to get him here for a very long time, was sort of my first introduction into what it means to come to the United States as a non-citizen. And so when Emily first volunteered with Celia and with Catholic Charities, she actually came home that night and we heard her come in. We heard the garage door close, and then no Emily. She didn't appear into the house. And so I went to the garage and she was sitting in her car sobbing. And I said, whoa, what happened? Did you get in an accident? Did you what happened? And she said, Mom, we have to do this work. We have to do this work. It is so important. I need you to support me in this. I need you to be there with me. And we have to do this. And I said, okay, all right. So she came in the house and explained the process to me. And from there, I said, okay, well, then we have to do it ourselves. We need to get a group together. We have a large congregation. We have a social justice committee. Let's just do this. So we did.
And we're going to talk about the process in a moment, but I do want to go to Elena Yoder. You're with a Mennonite church, and I did get an email. It was through a couple of connections of people from the Mennonite Church that I got hold of you. And I was told that, and actually we spoke briefly, and you said that you had been in Guatemala and Honduras. Were you actually living there?
Yes, we lived.
Wait, let me get your mic on. I hold on. I'm so sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, we lived in Honduras 18 years and in Guatemala 10 years.
And what were you doing there?
Well, I created a program for students to learn Spanish and culture in Guatemala City. And in Honduras, I was a home mom, and I just supported my husband in his work.
So starting the organization, was that something? Did that have anything to do with the Mennonite Church, or just something you did on your own?
It did, but that's not what made me do it exactly. Mm-hmm. It was just I saw students coming and going, and they'd go to these places where maybe four or five students lived in one household, and I said, that's not the way to learn Spanish. And so we decided to form our own program for students from the U.S. to learn Spanish and the culture with one student in a home.
So that's a lot of years living. Tell me again the number of years.
Would be 28 years altogether.
In both countries?
Yes.
Wow. That's almost a lifetime.
That's right.
Or a young lifetime.
And then, of course, we traveled all over Central America, and I also had the experience of meeting people who returned and saw how hard it was for them to readjust.
Return from?
From here.
From here. They went back to their countries.
Yes.
So when was the last year that you were in living in Central America?
The last year I lived there was in 93, but I'd been back several times to visit.
Did you anticipate a situation like this where there would be lots of Central Americans coming to the border?
No, I didn't. I never dreamed that so many Guatemalans would come, as well as Hondurans, but especially Guatemalans. I never dreamed that. Mm-hmm. Never even imagined it.
So what brought you to do this work here now, working with those that are coming from those countries?
In our church, we have a lot of people involved, and they're sort of the ones that called me into this work, which I really enjoy, and I do it because I have a real feeling for the people of Central America. I know their situation pretty well.
Right. You know, the reason I asked you a moment or two ago about whether the work that you did there when you were in, was that Guatemala first?
Or Honduras first,
if that had to do with the church, because I was told that in trying to find connections to ask some of you to be on the show, that there are lots of Mennonites who have, I think, lived in Central America in those countries.
It had to do with our church. We worked for our church there, yes.
Okay. All right, so there are so many steps now. There are buses arriving, and there are different organizations taking on these busloads of people. They first, tell me if I got this the order of this right, they arrive at the border, they, in a sense, those who are saying they're asylum seekers, they surrender, so to speak, to ICE. ICE has to process them, and sometimes that takes several days. And at that point, when they're at the border and they're waiting and they're being processed, I read somewhere that some have been in pens. Is that generally the case now? I know they're running out of space, so they say, down there. Celia?
From what I've heard, the conditions they're being kept in are not good at all. Some of them are, the folks coming are telling us what they're experiencing. And so, yes, I believe it's something like pens or something like that. But the thing we've heard more recently also was that they were rationing water to them. So our last bus that arrived were really dehydrated.
Right.
So there's a lot of issues with that.
Emily?
A lot of people saw in the news the kind of makeshift detention center, if you even want to call that, under the bridge in El Paso. We had quite a few folks on our last bus that were under that bridge. And not only were they experiencing rationing with food and water, but also physical violence.
And often sleeping on concrete, or maybe there's a mat under there or something like that. No mat, just sleeping on concrete. So then they finally get processed as asylum seekers, and ICE puts them on a bus. And I don't know if they're going to other cities as well, but Jessica?
Yes, so absolutely. There are lots of places within our state and actually in Texas as well, because we are part of the El Paso sector where there are lots of organizations throughout our entire state, not just in Albuquerque, in lots of different parts of our state who are accepting busloads of folks. And on average, I think we're up to somewhere in the several hundred people are being released every single day.
So the recent number today was about 825 were released. So every single day, around 700 to 800 are released out of El Paso. And just to be clear, they do not go directly to ICE to us. We are all receiving buses here in Albuquerque through Ruben Garcia, who is the director of Annunciation House in El Paso. So that's a really important step, because ICE just may stop doing that. And that's a really crucial step in our organization, is to have that communication with Ruben. And so if ICE and CBP make good on some of the threats they've made, they actually won't go through him, and then buses will just show up. But when they go through Ruben, we've had communications, we plan it, and we expect, and we're ready to welcome those folks.
Well, that closes a puzzle for me, because a friend of mine mentioned the other day, I told her I was doing this show, and she mentioned Ruben Garcia, and I said, well, who is he? And she said, you never heard of Ruben Garcia?
He's famous.
And actually, I never heard of the Ruben Garcia that she was talking about. So I wound up, for whatever, wherever our conversation went, I didn't get a clear explanation as to what he's doing. So it's through him.
He's been the director of the NCH House for 30 years, or so, for many, many years. And he just came to Albuquerque a couple weeks ago, because he's trying to reach out to new places to encourage us to take buses. And we'd already been taking buses with him through Catholic Charities since February, but he's done an appeal more widespread to the Albuquerque community. Las Cruces has been one of the big places to take many, many buses, but because the numbers have been high for so long, many places are just starting to get burnt out and lose resources, and that's why they made it to Albuquerque.
We're going to find out why there's some burnout in a few minutes. You wanted to say something, Emily.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, when I started working with Congregation Albert on our own, we worked with Ruben, but I didn't know much about him. And just a week or two ago, the Washington Post did a whole article. So if anyone is curious to learn more, I mean, I've been working with him, and I learned what an incredible person he is through that article. So
they can Google Washington Post, Ruben Garcia. And find something. Well, the efforts are really tremendous. So they finally get released from ICE. They get on the bus, and they make their way to a place where there's already been arranged for them to stay. And that is where you come in, Jessica. For example, there are other groups, but for the buses that you and with the volunteers from Temple Albert, this is the bus load that you agreed to take. You do one bus load at a time.
Right. And it's typically a 4-day process. One thing I do want to point out that's important is that when folks are put on the bus and they're coming to our location, we're not talking about a luxury bus here. We're talking about a prison-style caged bus that they are transported to.
Are there cages inside the bus? The windows are the windows... got bars or anything?
Yeah. It's a prison bus, basically.
It's an ICE bus.
Yes, it's an ICE bus, the prison bus. And what I wanted to say about that is that they don't know where they're going. So when they get on that bus and they're coming to us, they aren't told, oh, you're going to a place that's going to help you. They're not told anything. And very often when they get off the bus, they are incredibly scared. I mean, they're walking through the lobby of the hotel. They don't know who we are. They don't know we're there to help them. And it's really important for us. And, you know, we say this repeatedly to our volunteers, even if you don't speak Spanish, please just smile. Please just let them know in whatever way you can with your body language or words that, you know, we are here to help.
And right
help
now
you.
They're okay.
Right. Now you are safe.
So, what was I going to say? So you said they were, it's like they were in, do they or do they not know at that point? Because right now it doesn't sound like they do know. These are people who are coming, who are going to be cared for in the city where they are, and then they're going to be ready after one of the teams communicates their sponsor. So have they been already assigned a sponsor, but they don't, and in many cases it's their family.
So to be released by ICE, they have to have already told a sponsor, and so they've communicated with their family member, or whether New York, California, wherever their family member is, and that family member has agreed to take them in, and they have a court date in their new location. So ICE is not just releasing them to think they'll eventually figure out how to get. They know in 15 days I have to be in New Jersey with my family at this court date. And just to make one more thing clear, when they're processed, they all do a background check. And I do just want to make clear to folks who have concerns about people coming into our country, if they had a criminal background at all in any place, they would not be allowed in. Right. So they're made sure they've never committed crimes in the United States. They're allowed in with the idea that they will go directly to their sponsor and have a court date, at which point they'll have to try to prove their asylum case.
So in the end, they kind of know they're going to a sponsor, but here they are after a long 2 weeks on the road, maybe 3 weeks on the road. I just want to go to Elena, because I think she had something she wanted to say.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what she said about them coming without knowing where they are.
Oh, yeah.
I had one lady from the airport tell me how she had a woman that came in and was going to fly, and she thought she was in New York. She had no idea where she was here.
Wow. That's, yeah, I guess that's understandable when you go through all that you've gone through.
Absolutely.
And Emily, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, certainly our state being called New Mexico confuses people too, because they, some of them think they're back in Mexico. But I was going to say, just following up on what Celia was saying, this last bus that we received, a lot of people did not have a sponsor listed on their immigration documents. Their mm-hmm. sponsor was the General Consulate of Honduras in New York City, or et cetera, et cetera. And that makes for a very interesting process for us, because unless they know a name or number of their sponsor, I mean, we can't call the consulate and ask them to help. So
that's more of an infrequent happening? Yeah.
Well, I think the problem is that we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah.
So I think one of the challenges for all of us working on this is that every week something is different. So we can't get into a system where everyone calms down because something else happens. So we had been in a system, but what is happening now at the border, if you just, you know, look at the news at all, you know that they are definitely in a mode of not knowing how to handle folks. So more folks are going to be released just into the street without actually being processed. And I think what Emily is seeing and what more of us will see more and more is there was this orderly system that ICE had in place, and that is starting to deteriorate because resources are not being put by the government into those places to fix those structures when there's so many more people coming. So that, what Emily's talking about, that's going to be a real challenge. We expect we might see more people without papers, which is going to be a real challenge. We may see people without the ankle bracelet that, and we have seen already, that had they had been coming with. And I know that I think it was yesterday, the day before, ICE just did drop a whole bunch of folks in Las Cruces, and they were not connected through a group to support. They were just dropped there with no notice, almost no notice to the city. So,
oh no.
So every week something different is happening, yeah, and we just all are trying our best mm-hmm. to respond to it with compassion and with kindness and with the volunteer strength. But it's hard because it's really unpredictable.
If you just tuned in, this is Women's Focus. My name is Carol Boss. In the studio, I have four women, and they're all involved in one way or the other with efforts to support and assist the migrants. And they've been called, and they are. They're people who declared at the border that they're asylum seekers. And there's we're going to hear about what this whole process is like once they reach Albuquerque. So I'm welcoming, again, Emily Alvarez and Jessica Corley, Celia Yapita, and Elena Yoder. So I'm glad you're here. So you are, both you and your daughter, Jessica, you and daughter Emily are
site coordinators.
So right. The bus gets here. Mm-hmm. You're there to meet them at the hotel.
Right. So what we have, so each of the organizations has their own sort of tweak on the structure that they use in order to help folks get to their sponsors. But what we decided to do, and, you know, basically we had a 2.5-day notice that we were going to do this the very first time. And so we did a mass appeal to our congregation. I called folks at Nahalat that I knew, and it just spread from there. The net just widens when you ask for volunteers in our community, which is a wonderful thing. So what we've done in our structure is we've created team leads and teams. So we have teams such as the intake team, and we have teams that are the travel agent team. We have the hospitality team. We have the medical team.
I've never seen so many teams in my life. You sent me a list of them. It is awesome.
Yes.
And unbelievable.
Yeah,
really.
So and each of those teams have a job description, and they have a team lead, and they're responsible for getting volunteers to do the tasks that are required within each of those teams. Some of them, Spanish speaking is required, some are not, which really is helpful for us in terms of volunteers, so that we can have folks there that are, you know, providing a meal or, you know, helping folks pick out a new outfit in what we call our store, which is our donation room, where folks can go in and get a new pair of clothing, new pair of shoes or shoelaces. Most of the folks, or actually all of the folks that come to us come with their clothes on their backs. And very often they haven't had an opportunity to bathe for several days or weeks. They haven't been fed a real meal, a warm meal, in several weeks. And so, you know, our priority is to welcome them, to let them, you know, have some time and some privacy inside their hotel room where they can shower, they can put on fresh clothes. And then our very first gathering of all of the volunteers and all of the folks, we call them our guests, that we all sit together and have a meal together, a warm meal that's been provided by an organization or another. In our case, Nahalat Shalom has been providing lots of warm meals for our folks where they have a group of people that get together and cook a meal and bring it over. And that's the time when we really get to sit down and breathe while behind the scenes, the travel agent team is furiously contacting sponsors and trying to arrange for travel because, as Celia said, part of the process is getting them to their home locations with their sponsors as quickly as possible because they do have dates for their asylum cases. And so that's, you know, that's what that team does is make those travel arrangements.
So would you say that ICE is at least good at giving you the phone numbers and the contact information for the sponsors?
Well, they had been until Emily was just telling us that a few. They all come. They had all come with the same five sheets of paper mm-hmm. that say, "This is who you are. This is the name. This is the spelling of your name that we're choosing to give you. That will have to be your official spelling of your name, whether accurate or not. And this is your court date. And this is the city you have to be in. And then we call the number that the sponsor is on the paperwork to get in touch with the sponsor. But again, you know, that is if ICE is following all the rules that they wanted to follow with that. And so. Who knows if that'll be the case going forward.
What happens when they come to the border and they, quote unquote, surrender to ICE, if they need medical attention and also if they get off the bus and they clearly need medical attention? Jessica?
Well, I can't speak to what happens at the border because I don't know, and we've heard varying stories from various people. But at our location, we have a medical team, and they're all medical professionals on our medical team, all docs, nurse practitioners, and RNs. Through the loveliness of all of our volunteers, we're able to purchase all of the medical supplies that we need. They all get sort of a basic medical check, and when they're coming off the buses, we have the docs standing in line, and they're just eyeballing people as they get off and pulling people out of the line if they feel like they need immediate medical care. Most of the medical issues that we run into have been upper respiratory things, dehydration, as Celia said, and lots of foot problems from having, you know, journeyed hundreds and hundreds of miles through, you know, not nice terrain. So that's a lot of what we see.
Celia.
So there are about five groups now that are officially receiving buses into Albuquerque, and we all work together a lot. And so as Jessica's talking about her teams, we all have very similar team structures, and we might tweak it a little bit. We all have medical teams that have retired doctors or nurses on them. And we also get a lot of support from the city of Albuquerque mm-hmm. in helping to coordinate the communication and the discussion. So just yesterday, we had a phone call, and we're going to have it once a week between, again, the five groups that are taking buses. And if more add, they'll join on too. So that we're all making sure that medical is being taken care of. Challenges of overflow at the bus station. You know, do we have enough seats on buses to get out of town? And of course, I think Elena helps with all the support at the airport, which is crucial because getting folks through TSA who don't have a passport or identification was a lot of behind the scenes communication to get a flow going. And we have amazing volunteers at the airport who help with that part, or we could never do that part either. We have a team of volunteers at the airport who work on that.
Yeah, I'm going to ask, go ahead. Elena.
I was just going to say, besides all the meals that they provide, they also provide sack lunches yes. for the people to take on the buses and on the airplanes. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy to see that because some of our people can't even leave until the next morning, mm-hmm. early in the next morning. So those meals are so important for the airport people and the bus people.
So when you're sitting down for meals and you're there, did you start to see pretty soon thereafter the tension, the fear kind of lifting from them? Emily, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, so my memory is, you know, when they're first walking in and it's just, you know, these terrified looks and they're unsure and all of that. And a day later, 2 days later, you know, you're running around, watching little kids run around with a soccer ball in the hotel.
And laughing and being a kid.
Laughing. Yeah. And I think for a lot of, especially the children, it's the first time they've been allowed to be a kid and play and laugh and be happy and not be afraid in so long. And, you know, to watch little kids be able to do that is really beautiful. And to be able to see the relieved looks on the parents' faces when they see their kids being able to experience that.
Jessica, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to say part of our team, we're fortunate to have a social worker that comes in and works with children that she feels are particularly traumatized. And we also provide some art supplies, and we have a group of art folks that come in to do art projects with the kids so that they can express their feelings or emotions or whatever is going on for them in a way that's safer for them. So, you know, as we're getting better at this, we're getting, you know, not just providing the basics of, you know, food and clothing, but we're really trying in the short time that we have folks to help them on their journey of healing.
What would be the shortest amount of time? And, well, you've only had one bus so far.
No.
Two buses.
We've had two, and we have another one coming on Monday.
Up, right.
Yeah. So
they usually stay, could be up to several days, depending on what happens with the sponsor and getting in contact with them.
Yeah, so the average has been 48 hours between the organizations, which is amazing. We are not there yet. Our average is probably closer to 3 or 4 days, not 2 days. We always have a family here or there that's the last family to leave us on the fourth or third day.
Yeah, some of it's just luck, and some of it's also we took our ninth bus this week. We had 100 people at one time. So some groups are taking 50 at a time, and we have the ability to take 100 at a time.
So when you say we, you're talking about
Catholic Charities.
Has there, that organization has a bus, is taking buses.
Exactly. So there's five organizations taking buses right now: Catholic Charities, Congregation Albert, I'm going to forget some of these, Lutheran Family Services, Albuquerque Interfaith, and St. Michael's and All Angels. So there's very, and when I list the name, there's about 20 different supporting groups to that name. Right. It's just we identify it as one. So Catholic Charities has taken either 50 or 100 every week, and we just took our ninth bus. So sometimes we can get them out within 12 hours. I mean, it just depends on how quickly you can get a hold of the sponsor, how quickly the sponsor can buy the ticket, availability of ticket. But we really want to get them on their way as quickly as possible. So I think 2 to 4 days is probably, you know, but even us, we might get 80-90% out within a day and a half. And then we'll have two or three families that linger a little longer because their family has a hard time purchasing the ticket.
Right.
Emily,
just keeping in mind that a lot of times their sponsors are also immigrants, also don't have a lot of money, are struggling. And so, you know, sometimes they say, well, I don't have a credit card or a debit card, so I have to go get my cash and send it to someone else, et cetera, et cetera. And just giving them the time to get their finances in order and be able to purchase that ticket takes time.
I didn't realize that scenario existed, that some of them are immigrants themselves and may not have much. Yeah, that makes sense.
And just one more challenge that's important to mention is that coming from Guatemala, and maybe Elena knows more about this too, they speak many indigenous languages. So Spanish may not be their first language. Mm-hmm. So we have definitely off and on with some of our buses had a few people who speak Quechua, Quiche, Cancobal, like languages that I had never heard of before about 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And we don't have a whole lot of those speakers here in Albuquerque. So and we also have had buses with Portuguese speakers, folks coming from Brazil. Mm-hmm. So we've really, I think, tapped into some amazing people in our community who I didn't realize we had so many Portuguese speakers. And so they volunteered, I think, on all the teams to help. And for the languages, we had a couple amazing folks who had connections around the country with Quechua speakers. So we had a number we could call to do like a three-way interpretation. So that's a barrier for the families as well, that it's not just a Spanish barrier. It's that they speak another language.
I got to play one announcement. So if you can hold on, and you're not going to hear it because you don't have headsets on. So just bear with me. In silence.
The Santa Fe Desert Chorale presents the 2019 Spring Concert, Illuminating the Dome, featuring a cappella choral treasures from the Orthodox tradition, led by artistic director Joshua Haberman. The chorale will perform works by Russian, Estonian, Finnish, British, and American Orthodox composers in Santa Fe on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. and in Albuquerque on Sunday, April 28th at 2 p.m. Tickets at desertchorale.org or 505-988-2282. A message from the tax-exempt Santa Fe Desert Chorale.
Okay, this is Women's Focus that you're in tune to. I'm Carol Boss, and in the studio with me is Emily Alvarez and Jessica Corley and Celia Yapita. and Elena Yoder. And I welcome, I'm so happy that you're here and that we could talk about this. Because I have a feeling that there are probably a lot of people that are really unaware of this process. And maybe some people haven't been aware of the buses coming. Weekly Alibi just did a really nice article. The writer did actually went to one of the sites, and that was the Albuquerque Interfaith bus people. And that was really nice. And he also talked about getting to be where they had a dinner and just seeing kids fly, you know, tossing paper airplanes in the air. And just that, you know, makes me feel so wonderful to know that they're getting that experience. Yeah. So I asked Celia if she thought this was sacred work, and you gave your reason, Emily, for doing this, and Jessica, your mom, was told by the daughter, Emily, that we've got to do this work. If you look on it on a larger level, what does all of this mean to you? For me, I think about community and goodness, and that's one thing, and coming together, and you know, I haven't lived in a whole lot of different cities, but I think of Albuquerque as a really excellent volunteer town mm-hmm. where people come out when needed. And you want to respond, Celia?
Absolutely. I mean, again, none of this work could be done without the, I mean, probably hundreds of volunteers now who have stepped up to do this. When we had about 12 hours notice before we got our first bus because we got an urgent call from the bishop in El Paso saying, you have to take this bus. And so the next morning we started trying to plan for it and we did our best. But we worked with New Mexico Faith Coalition for Immigrant Justice as well as the New Mexico Dream Team. So those two groups had provided a lot of support when back in May of 2018, which I don't know if everyone knows this, about 200 or so similar asylees did come through Albuquerque. It happened really fast. A lot of people from Faith Coalition and Dream Team stepped up and did amazing work. And then we never had another bus or didn't hear anything about it again. So there are hundreds of volunteers affiliated with those two groups who bring a passion and empathy and just such kindness in the work that they do. And so when we got our first notice of that first bus, I reached out to those folks and they came forward immediately. And so I think all the other teams probably experienced the same thing, to see people who are like, people need help and they need me now. I'm there in 2 or 3 hours. When this work can be exhausting and it can be so challenging and it's been overwhelming that it keeps changing and there's but the support and the amazing work we see from the volunteers, that's for me, that's the power that we have here in Albuquerque. And that's what keeps me going each week, you know, when it's really hard.
Do you feel there's a moral imperative? Jessica.
Most definitely. I have no question in my mind that there's a moral imperative. You know, as Jews, we know this story. We know this story very well. The whole tenet of Judaism, of Tikkun Olam, which means repairing the world, is our mandate as Jews and as people to do what we can to make the world a place that we all are equal, a place that we all have what we need to survive, and that the only way to do that is to step up and do the work. And, you know, I am so incredibly proud of the volunteers that we've gotten through all different organizations, not just Congregation Albert, but, you know, last week the administrator at Congregation Albert said to me, hey, could you come over? I have some gift cards that were donated. I said, sure. So I walked in the office and literally, she handed me 67 gift cards from stores so that we can go and purchase the things that we don't get donated, food items and shoes and things like that that we don't get donated.
In a short while, don't let me end this without talking about how to tell people how they can volunteer and how to get in contact. But I want to go to Elena right now in terms of, let's say, the tenets of the Mennonite Church.
I was going to say, I think many churches and groups of people—
yes.
are coming together with food and meals to help with each of these organizations. And I think it's a wonderful experience for people to reach out like that, and I've been amazed. It seems like it's a never-stop program. It just goes on and on and on, and people respond.
When I was looking for contacts for this show, someone told me or gave me names from the Mennonite Church and said there are lots of Mennonites. Did I say this before? I don't think so. That have spent time in Guatemala and Honduras. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with the church?
Yes. Yes, we've also had a lot of volunteers who have helped people with gardening and bettering their lives in some form or other.
So you go to the airport, and this is sort of like the last step once the bus arrives here in Albuquerque, and sometimes it's the bus station that you go to.
I never go to the bus station, just to the airport.
Oh, you're the airport person, but some of them go to the bus station.
Right, yes.
And you told me when I got hold of you on the phone to see if you wanted to come on the show, you were talking about how the TSA people and the folks at the airport have been incredible. So you want to talk about that experience of do you actually bring them to the airport or you meet them at the airport?
We meet them at the airport.
Okay.
We always have a person who's there to greet them. Yes, I would love to talk about it. I have been overwhelmed and amazed at the kindness of the airport people. We have received such support from the airport because these people have never flown before in their lives. And especially the children are interested and somewhat afraid, but we try to accompany them all the way to the security, and then on the other side of the security, we take them to their gates, and we talk to airport personnel to help them at the next airport where they're flying to make their transitions to the next plane. And I have been amazed and so grateful to see how helpful they are in sending people to meet these people, or either by sending a person or by sending a wheelchair and getting them to the next gate. If you can understand how hard it is to navigate an airport when you've never been through one, that'll give you an idea of how much that means to us.
Jessica. Yeah, thank you, Elena.
Yeah, the airport support that we all get as organizations working with our folks, I mean, obviously we are responsible to get them to the airport or to the bus station, but once we get there, it's such an amazing feeling to know that we are passing our folks off to a group of volunteers who have been trained and who are ready to receive those folks and help them through the next process. It's hard. I mean, we get in a short 3 days, we get attached to folks, and it's like, you know, we have people that come and volunteer, and they're not on our transport team, which is the team that drives them, but they come and, you know, they call and say, can I bring my family to the airport? And it's like, my family? And they're like, you know, the one I worked with yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's you know, so we get that whole sense. But just also, I had a family that I spoke with after they had arrived at their sponsor's home. And she said to me, you know, when we got to the airport, we didn't know what those stairs were that were moving. Of course, she was talking about the escalator. And so, you know, for us, I mean, we just don't have that frame of reference. We just don't think that way. And for these folks to be going into this airport, and, you know, we all know Albuquerque Airport is a tiny little airport in comparison to, you know, New York City or some other larger cities. But just the you know, just how huge that is of an experience for them on their first journey leaving here.
Elena?
I would just like to mention, too, that there are people on those flights that come and offer to walk alongside these people that are traveling. Some say they don't know much Spanish, and others say they know a little bit, but they offer to accompany them or to be there for them when they're needed.
Celia.
I think just the what warms all of our hearts is I've seen that example happen at the bus station as well, where someone comes back and said, you know what, there was someone who's taking a bus and they just bought the person a burrito and they said they would help them get on. I mean, so just seeing that it's not just the volunteers here working hard, but just out people out there in the world, they see these folks are struggling and they want to help and they do these little things that are enormous.
Emily.
I'm sure my mom is going to say the same thing. We both itching to talk. We had people at the hotel and it was two young gentlemen, and it's really easy to pass judgment, and when we saw them, we were like, oh no, they want to talk to us. And they were like, hey, we have two separate hotel rooms. We will share a room. Take one of our rooms for free.
Wow.
Just a random person. We've had a little boy that was staying at the hotel that we stay at, told his mom that he wanted to buy stuff, toys and stuff for the kids, and brought them for them. Just little things like that. People at the store, when they see us buying 400 travel deodorants and ask what it's all about, and you explain it, and they just give you $20 right on the spot. I mean, just no matter where we go, there's just people, good people, and it's the reason we keep doing this work.
Does anybody have, I'm sure you have a lot of memorable stories. You have the story about the family you fell in love with, and your about being able to communicate with them and anything anyone wants to share, because I love hearing the stories.
Well, sure. I mean, the last bus that we took, I had an opportunity one afternoon. I can remember because the days blur together when you're in the midst of it, but it might have been the second or third day. And there were three women sitting around a table in the lobby of the hotel, and I went over and sat with them. And my Spanish is about 75%, so enough that I can communicate. Don't always get the verbs correct, but enough that I can communicate with them. And just hearing the stories of what they faced in their home countries, the reasons that they came, and their willingness to share their stories with me. You know, I had a family that had a little tortilla sort of shop out of their home, and, you know, they had to leave because they kept getting extorted and extorted and extorted, so much so that they basically either had to pay or were going to be murdered, and decided to, you know, take the journey with their six-year-old. It's actually the only whole family that we've ever had in our bus. It was a man and his wife and his their daughter, and the three of them, you know, made the trek from Honduras, the northern part of Honduras. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was quite the trek. And fortunately, they had enough resources that they could bus it most of the way, but did still have, you know, several hundred miles to walk. And, you know, the story of having to lose and give up everything in order to come and seek safety. And, you know, they were my family.
Well, you're talking about your family being extorted. What are some of the other reasons why people make that decision? And maybe there winds up not really truly being a choice. Why do they leave? Is it?
I think from what I've heard, it is along the lines of gang violence and extortion.
Gangs.
I mean, that seems to be the majority of what we've heard. I mean, there may be also other reasons that are happening, but that is what we're seeing the most of.
Is there a land ever taken away from them?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the three women that I got to talk with, since this is a woman's show, those three women talked a lot about sexual violence that was just prevalent in their village, and that either you did what you were supposed to do, in other words, whatever the will was of the person that was assaulting you, or they would murder you, and that they had seen their friends, their neighbors murdered for not, you know, for not complying with being sexually abused or raped by village people or people from neighboring villages or gangs or whomever wanted to do that. And so a lot of them were, you know, they're all escaping for their children.
So most of them are coming with children.
All of them are coming with children.
So, so all of them are families. So I know that was a little different from previous things that have happened where children had been separated. These are, but for the most part, as Jessica was saying, they're single parents with kids. So we've only had, I think, a couple families where it was the mother and the father and the kids. But we had one bus that was 100% men with their teenage sons.
Yes.
And I'm not sure why we never know who we're going to get off the bus ever. but that was a different dynamic. And I have seen these, you know, I have children, and so I remember what my very young children were like when they were one or two, and you know, how engaged they are and how creative and how they're exploring. And so you do see that difference when these children arrive, and to see little babies that look in shell shock, really, like they don't have that they've at least temporarily forgotten that natural instinct of things that they could do as a little tiny kiddo. And you see them get as Emily was saying, you see them get more comfortable with that. But yeah, single parents with children, sometimes a bus of 50 will have 19 to 20 two families. You know, some families have three or four kids, but for the most part, you know, each bus of 50 has somewhere around there.
So is it ever? So sometimes it's two parents with kids, and sometimes one.
It's been really rare. Like I think Jessica said, you guys. I think we've seen once.
For the
most part, they've been separated from the other parent.
Right.
Yes,
I was Elena. Just going to say one man from a rural area said that his land dried up. Mm. And he could no longer provide food for his family.
Mm. Yeah. So if anyone's listening and has a desire and interest to find out more about maybe perhaps being a team member, we've got two things. We've got being active when they're here, but also there's a lot of collection and donations of food and toys and et cetera, et cetera. Do you want to address that, Celia?
Absolutely. So there's so many groups in the community we've worked with. One is Indivisible Knob Hill. So Indivisible Knob Hill is a group of amazing volunteers who I, again, didn't really know much about before a couple months ago. So they have helped us by creating a volunteer database that is accessible to all five groups or whatever the expanded number becomes who need volunteers. And the volunteer form that you would fill out with them, and I'll explain where it is in a minute, does go through the teams and explain because, again, most of us are using a team model. So if you felt like you wanted to do medical because you were a medical professional, you would check that. If you felt like you wanted to do donations team because you maybe didn't speak Spanish as well, but you want to be behind the scenes sorting, you check that option. If you speak Spanish, you know, there's a place on there to indicate that as well as Portuguese. So one place to go is to Catholic Charities website, which is www.ccasfnm.org.
Say that again.
www.ccasfnm.org. And if you Google Catholic Charities Albuquerque, you'll come up with the same thing. And if you, we've called our effort Companions on the Journey. I think everyone has come up with a beautiful name for their own effort. Ours is Companions on the Journey. So if you scroll down just a little bit on our website, there's a link to a volunteer form that you can submit. And again, that is not just for Catholic Charities volunteers. That form and that database will be used by any of the programs. It also tells you where to make donations. And we have a centralized donation site that all of the groups can access. It is at St. Francis Xavier Church, and it gives you the address on there. They're open for receiving Monday to Friday during, I think, 9 to 5. And then all of the teams can use that as a place to draw donations from. And we have an amazing person there, Jan, who helps organize everything. And we can go there and help organize with our volunteers. But as far as donations and volunteers, there's a centralized place on our website where everybody can access to help.
Jessica.
And just in speaking about collaboration and all of how the teams work together, for example, the hotel that we use. So let me go back a little bit. We've surmised that it takes about between $5,000 and $6,000per busload to house them, clothe them, feed them. That's our team. I don't know. We've done our own sort of little accounting of it. But for example, our hotel is upwards of $2,800 each time. And so this last time, this bus that we took previous to the one that we're going to take next week, Catholic Charities paid for our hotel, and they're paying for our next one as well. So, you know, we come up with the funds needed to, you know, purchase the clothing that we need or whatever supplies that we might need in order to provide the best possible care we can. But without the financial donations and the financial backing of Annunciation House, who has paid before, of Catholic Charities, who is sharing the money that they get donated to help us pay for our hotel, Congregation Albert would not be able to do it, or other organizations. So we collaborate in that way, and that's a beautiful thing.
And just thank you for mentioning that, Jessica. You can also donate on our website for money. I didn't want to leave out the money part. You're absolutely right. So you can click on a button, and it says clearly that you're donating to the general, like, city wide asylee effort, and that's the pool of money that we share with any of the groups that need that assistance. And it's been going the majority to pay hotels.
Yeah, I didn't realize there was this pool. It's really pretty wonderful. Also, you like to get gift cards for
specific gift cards, Walgreens, because we often have to buy prescriptions for folks. Obviously, they're not coming to us with health insurance. And so when we need to buy a prescription for, you know, something that's going on with one of our guests, we have to go buy that over the count. You know, we have to buy that at cost. So we take them from Walgreens, from Target, and from Walmart.
So how does that work with the pool then? Is that part of one of the donations that go on the list?
I think it's kind of separate too. So we're all kind of have our individual efforts, and then we also have our joint effort, and
right.
It's all good. So if you know one of the places I've just listed and you want to contact, you know, whether Congregation Albert or one of the churches, you can just donate directly to that effort. But our website also has an Amazon wish list. So, one of those things I didn't really know too much about before we tried this effort. But for example, when we need new underwear, that's not something where we want it. We need fresh new underwear. You can go there and you can buy it through Amazon, and it'll get delivered directly to a location. And then that also can get shared. So there's multiple ways to help, whether giving money or in kind, and or just giving directly to someone who you hear about today who's doing the effort.
Do you give them a little cash on their way back?
We do. I think most groups do. So what we do is folks that are going on buses. So typically the people that are taking buses are going all the way across the country, New York, Florida, Washington, D.C. And so we try and give those families enough food to last for their 3-day journey if we can. And we also try and give them at least $20 so they have some cash in their pocket. Folks that are flying, we give them a little bit less because they have less needs during their travel time. But the other thing that's really important that we've done, not done, and we're going to continue to now do is to make sure that we're able to give a disposable cell phone to each family, so with 60 minutes of talk time on it, so that we can communicate with them, they can communicate with their sponsors. You know, travel in America today, you know how that is. You know, there's delays, there are things happening that for you and I would be an okay thing. It's, you know, sort of a pain, but you know, if our flight was delayed, we would know what to do. Or you know, if our flight was actually canceled, we would know what to do. And these folks often don't know what to do because they've never been on these kinds of journeys by bus or by plane. And so having that phone has been a really huge part. We didn't do it one bus that we took, and it was a disaster for us not being able to communicate with our folks and having them not be able to communicate. That's a cost. That's $40 per phone, $20 for the phone, $20 for the phone card. And that adds up when you're talking about doing 20 of those, you know, that's a lot of money. So that's something that we spend the cash on that we get for donations or people go and purchase the phones for us.
Celia?
So I wanted to say about the phones, because that's been a headache of ours since we started this as well.
Yes.
We've actually been able to find them a little cheaper than that, just like
14.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. but you can't just go and buy 100 phones, we realized. And we found this out really quickly because people suspect that you're doing something illegal with drugs if I just go and buy a bunch of burner phones. So we found that a best way to do this is individuals to buy. I think you can buy up to 5 at a time.
Depending
on the store. And so if everyone out there listening went and bought 5 phones and donated them, then we would be covered for a while, because we also do utilize those phones for the folks taking the longer journey. So this was one of those things that it took us a long time to figure out, but now it's basically individuals who can buy the cheap burner phones, buy the phone card to add the minutes onto the phone. Even better, activate the phones,
yes,
so that we don't have to spend hours activating the phones, and then donate that so that family has a way to communicate if they get lost or confused along their 50-hour bus trip to Orlando or wherever.
Right.
So just some little things we've learned along the way.
It's kind of hilarious. Actually, it's more ironic that you're trying to do this good, and the whole idea of buying this phone, these cheap phones in bulk, will arouse suspicion.
It does, yeah.
Okay, let's go to Elaine, and then we'll to Emily.
I just wanted to say it is very helpful when Catholic Charities or whoever else does this lets us know in the churches what your needs are, mm-hmm, because then our church rallies to that need.
Right.
And that way we can get that need supplied.
Right. Wonderful.
And Emily, did you want to say something?
I was just going to say that on top of that, a lot of stores don't have the phones in stock anymore.
We're
buying them out. We're buying them out. So I know you can get them on Amazon. You can only order a certain amount, but they are available on Amazon as well, just because there's not that many anymore in Albuquerque.
Yeah, our amazing and kind donations director, that first day, I think she bought them all out of Albuquerque.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, whoops, there we go. Now we got to start again.
Do the hotels know who they're getting? I mean, they must, right? Because suddenly you're booking a lot of rooms.
As I said, the first time we took a bus, we had about 2 days' notice. And one of the very first things was finding a location. So I started just going through. I knew we had a particular budget. And I happened upon a lovely general manager named Michelle, who we have been working with at the same hotel, and she works with the funding source, if it's Catholic Charities that's paying or Annunciation House, and the staff at the hotel that we stay at has been, I can't even say enough about how tremendous they've been in helping us. You know, most folks have never even been in a hotel. They don't know how the keys work. I mean, there are just all kinds of issues that come up that we don't think about. And the staff at the hotel that we work with and the general manager has been more than accommodating for all of our needs, and actually giving us breaks on the rate. And it's just been an amazing thing. As you probably know and can suspect, we keep our locations secret. Otherwise, I would be giving her a shout out for her hotel. But we do keep our location secret for safety, security, and privacy of our guests.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, and I want to thank you for coming here. I really so wanted to have this conversation. I wanted people to hear about these tremendous efforts that are happening right here in Albuquerque and also in other cities in New Mexico and probably in other cities around the country. So regardless of what Donald Trump has said, it sounds like we're not all full, right?
I would agree with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, our hearts and minds are very open to helping these folks, and that's what the people here are standing up to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for all of your work, and thank you for making time on this Saturday afternoon.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Emily Alvarez, and your mom. Thanks for inspiring her. Jessica Corley, and all the wonderful work that happens at Catholic Charities. You can check them out online. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to give the website again. So thank you, Celia Yapita.
Thank you.
And what is the website?
It is, again, www.ccasfnm.org.
And you don't have to be Catholic.
Absolutely not.
And Elena, thank you for taking time today.
You're welcome.
And thanks for all of your hard work.
Thank you.
Carol, I just wanted to say it's really important that there are folks like you doing media that are helping us get this story out and how important that is. So, in kind, thank you.